This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Want to become fitter, happier, more productive? Try life hacking. The use of apps and shortcuts and products that help you get things done faster so you can do even more. You can track your sleep habits, synchronize your to-do lists across all your machines, track your spending, and calculate your best personal bedtime. All designed to give you more time for meditation or yoga or whichever anti-anxiety method you choose to balance out the frenzy of our digital lives. Nikhil Saval is editor of N+1 and dug into the decidedly contemporary craze for life hacking and discovered its early industrial roots. We found his article, The Secret History of Life Hacking, in Pacific Standard Magazine. Nikhil Saval, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was being a little glib. Certainly, life hacking is so popular because people want more time for their quote-unquote real lives. Are they getting it?
No, it's becoming harder and harder. I mean, there's the level of just sort of anxiety and feeling overwhelmed, I think, is becoming a constant topic of discussion. Probably people are even getting overwhelmed by reading so many articles about being overwhelmed. It's just an issue of just the work exceeding the boundaries of the workday and also the workplace in a way that people probably haven't seen ever. Certainly not since the start of the Industrial Revolution.
So life hacking started as a kind of rebellious reclamation of personal time. I think of it as a little bit of a thumbing of the nose at corporate takeover of personal time. You describe it now as becoming just another hectoring paradigm of self-improvement. So has life hacking become, in a sense, also a job?
Yeah, I mean, there's a role suddenly for all these consultants, gurus, creators of apps, figures who didn't in a way exist, who then purvey advice on how to manage your life and somehow manage to get paid for it. On the other hand, it actually becomes a job in its own right for the person who is life hacking. I mean, it sort of adds extra tasks so that you can manage more tasks, and it sort of turns life itself into a kind of job. I mean, you ultimately have to figure out how to live your life only by treating it as some kind of work.
Bring us back to the origins of this desire to somehow rein in our personal chaos, which you said at the early 20th century industrial era.
That's right. I think that the craze for a kind of more efficient, just more productive existence really stems from the efficiency craze of the early 20th century. And I really start with the rise of scientific management and its founder, the infamous Frederick Winslow Taylor. At the time, it was really focused on the factory floor, which, you know, for Taylor and many of his acolytes was seen as this kind of no man's land when it came to productivity. Workers worked in sort of gangs that largely controlled their own workflow and process. I mean, they didn't control the factory, but they knew best how to do their work. And so Taylor rationalized this. He, in a way, hacked the tools of the trade by standardizing them, and most infamously of all, he introduced a stopwatch to measure the time it took for you to do certain motions. And this was really loathed by the workers themselves as much as it was kind of prized by Taylor's friends and his growing legion of fans who wanted to break workers' control over the work process and then introduce this class of people, these managers, who would then know better, so to speak, how workers can manage their work.
And these managers shared this obsession with efficiency, with controlling the minutiae. How did this change the work environment?
Broadly, what it did is it made work more standardized. Labor was divided up into sort of its composite parts, almost within an inch of its life.
They did these time and motion studies, like how many steps it takes to do things, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the time and motion studies, exactly, were meant to measure just the minimum, the bare minimum of motions, the maximum effort for the minimal amount of time that you needed for any part of the work process. Taylor did this with stopwatch. His acolytes did it with film. In a way, you see this in things like the film Moneyball, trying to break down baseball into certain kinds of repetitive actions. You know, and the other thing that it did is it created this class of people, these managers, who, in a way, it expanded the office bureaucracy by also limiting the number of workers on the shop floor. I think it meant to reduce the number of people who were doing this kind of work by making it much more efficient, but it increased the number of people who were studying the work process. So the tailors, once they had expanded the managerial class, realized that they actually had to rationalize the office and its clerical labor as well. And this, they turned their attention to every aspect of office life that seemed to be mechanical or factory. Like if workers spent too much time putting their papers in a sort of disarray and then cleaning them up and stacking them neatly, this had to be rationalized. If they were licking envelopes with a lackadaisical manner, that had to be timed and rationalized. If water fountains in offices were placed too far from the average worker, the tailors realized that they would calculate how many miles were lost each year in walking to and from the water fountain and would encourage, you know, better, more efficient water fountain placement just to make work feel a little bit more like a smooth-running machine.
We're talking about the surprising origins of the life hacking trend. That's the use of these time-saving apps and shortcuts to get things done that so many people rely on in our digital age. The writer Nikhil Saval is with us, and he traces this obsession with productivity to the time and motion engineers of the early 20th century. Well, Nikhil, you also point out some other parallels today, setting up kind of competition and a point system for workers. Tell us more about that.
That's right. I mean, one of the contemporary obsessions with things like gamification and turning chores into a kind of competition with people, you can see this in the way they treated workers, the tailors treated workers in the office. For example, they would, because people don't like being stopwatched, of course, and so the tailors would say, well, managers should go up to their employees and say, I wonder how long it takes you to do that job. And then to time that employee and then go to another employee and say, well, that employee did this in this amount of time. How fast can you do it? And this would basically create competition and individualistic striving among the workers with the idea that they would just treat this stopwatch thing as a game and not feel that they were being coerced.
So they begin to internalize it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that was really the ultimate goal of the tailors, was to make each worker feel like they were an individual somehow watching themselves mm-hmm. internally, that they had a stopwatch in their heads.
Yeah, I'm interested in that because, you know, this comes only not from the idea of maximizing profits, I guess, but from some of the more ideological concepts that were popular in social science at this time. The malleability of human beings, you know, the prison system changed a lot at this time with the idea that humans could be improvable. I'm curious about what that meant to workers' perceptions of themselves and their place in the world.
Well, it was equivocal. I mean, in a way, tailorism could only go so far in certain settings. For example, on the factory floor, it actually got rejected in many situations. Workers would go on strike. The labor movement was a little stronger in factory workplaces. And so tailorists actually had to retreat a little bit and work more on psychological methods of persuasion and management to make workers feel that they were part of a family at the workplace rather than being tested. In offices, I think it might have actually been a little bit easier because offices are so much about individualistic striving and meritocracy and competition among workers to rise up the company ladder rather than about collective purpose, that in a way it might have been easier for workers for that at least their setting was easier maybe for them to internalize the kind of things the tailors wanted of them.
So some of the effects here, we have a managerial class, right? There's a reinforcement of hierarchies, the sense of being watched. And now we're watching ourselves in a way that you call self-tailorization, quantifying calories and steps and shopping lists. Why would that appeal to us? And what do you think is the larger meaning?
Well, I mean, there's just this, you know, just when it comes to having metrics and numbers, that certainly is the spirit of the age, that we have technology that we can better measure, count calories, things like that. In a way, that's not totally new. It's just sort of an intensification of things we've already seen. But when it really comes to trimming hours out of our workday, ensuring that we have, you know, we're just efficiently doing everything we need to do in a given day and getting everything done, that, I think, comes out of a larger worry over work, the way work is just bleeding into everything that we do. And so, in a way, the response is just to treat everything like work. I mean, even the concept of a work-life balance really is about a work-work balance. You know, you're constantly turning every kind of activity into a form of work to create your sort of optimal, most efficient self.
Nikhil Saval, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
I guess we can, stop the stopwatch now. Nikhil Saval writes about the workplace. He is an editor of N+1 and author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can read his article for Pacific Standard about the secret history of life hacking and the cult of self-optimization. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Our search for answers is nearing its end, and word of mouth wraps with a medium of another sort that is near and dear to our heart, sound. This story comes from Rebecca Beeman and the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
We've gotten so far away from realizing how, you know, sound is in our everyday world, and it's all around us.
That's Sandra Chassé of Jaguar Woman Sounds. Sandra is a sound healer.
It takes a maverick to do sound. You have to be kind of a offbeat, you know. I'm just always a little left of center, I think, and always have been, kind of a rebel. And so to me, that's kind of fun. I like being different, and I like being a little weird.
Sound healing can seem pretty far-fetched. Sandra says she uses her voice, and sometimes instruments, to bring the energy in your body back into balance.
I mean, when you speak, comes out in sound waves, which is vibration, and those sounds, for example, is vibration, and what happens is that it shakes loose energy that's stuck.
You could think of sound healing like tuning a musical instrument. Today, Sandra's in her living room, about to start a healing session.
So, if there is anything that has come up for you this week, today,
Alicia Birdwood has never experienced sound healing before. Most people come to Sandra to face an emotional problem in their life, like wanting more confidence. Alicia, who's training to be a massage therapist, wants to stop holding herself back in her life.
I've missed out on a lot in life because I've kept myself in this little tiny crab shell. And I just need to now, you know, I've been peeking my head out for quite a while and my head's started to stay out and look around, but now I just need to get rid of the shell and just go, nope, I'm here.
At this point, you might be wondering, how could sound possibly fix this kind of problem? But there's more to this than you might think. It all starts with Sandra making Alicia feel safe to open up. As the two women sit on the floor, Sandra looks straight at Alicia's face and does not break eye contact.
One of the things we're taught in our training is 100% focus. You're there for them, them alone, and nobody else.
The first part of the session is a lot like psychotherapy. Alicia talks about what's on her mind. Sandra listens and gets her to focus on how she wants to feel after the session.
I am fully empowered and ready to help people.
Yes, you are. All right.
Yeah.
That's our intention, and that's what I'm going to be sounding into your body. And when I do that, in whatever way that happens, your cellular structure will change. The blocks will be gone so that you will feel in your body empowered and ready to do this work.
This might seem like a lot to accomplish just using sound. Sandra wasn't always convinced it would work either. It all started several years ago when she was recovering from knee surgery. She went to the Portland Free Clinic and they offered her an alternative healer. She found it actually helped, and soon became interested in doing healing herself. When she found out about sound healing, it was a revelation.
And I'd done a lot of years of talk therapy, but I could never feel that I could release or get to some of these very deep
feelings of trauma or whatever. And when I went to the sound workshop, it released it very easily. Just up it would come and whoa. And I knew that I wanted to do this for part of my life work.
Back at today's session, Alicia sits on the floor and Sandra leans over her from behind. With her hands on Alicia's shoulders and stomach, she starts blowing low sounds into Alicia's back. It sounds like a didgeridoo. Sandra says she trusts her intuition to tell her what sounds to make. Sometimes they're high-pitched like a siren, or sometimes they're animal roars. Today she uses low and guttural sounds because this healing is about empowerment. Alicia joins in.
And the sound helps you get through things. So it's not just that you're making these artificial sounds. They're real. They're of the essence of the agony that you're going through that moves you through to a new place.
Okay.
There's a moment when the noises Alicia's making, she really gets into them. Sandra makes her stand up and then pushes down on her shoulders, telling her to break free.
I will not be held down. I will not be held down.
Alicia shakes off Sandra's grip to show her newfound freedom. Her face relaxes and she breathes heavily. Now the two of them link arms and sway back and forth to let the feeling of freedom sink in.
All right. Keep that breath going.
Afterwards, Alicia says she feels transformed.
It was quite interesting because as we were like moving and dancing, all I could think of was just, I would never be the type of person that would go out to a karaoke bar and get up there and shake it. And now that was the only thing that I could think of was going out and just
expression.
Yes.
In whatever form it comes, I get to express.
Yes.
For Alicia, she says the sound really did make her feel empowered. And Sandra points out that a large part of her work is just helping people heal themselves. She helps them realize how they will make changes on their own.
You're responsible for your own healing here. I'm just the facilitator. It took you a long time to get to this place, you know? And it's going to take you some time to change an old pattern. And that's what healing really is.
Above all, Sandra listens. She pays attention. And maybe that, regardless of sound, is its own form of healing.
Rebecca Beeman there from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. Thank you for coming along as we probed life's big questions today. We hope we've provided some answers, or at the very least, entertained you. Entertainment therapy. That's an idea. If you'd like to learn more about the life coaches, psychics, astrologers, aura photographers, life hackers, or sound therapists we discussed on today's show, please visit wordofmouthradio.org, and you're welcome to share it with a friend. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth Monday at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.